Hey everybody, Simon Rettner here. Welcome to the Checkout Podcast. Jazz super bands are rare these days, especially the ones that come together organically, where all the individual players set aside their own star status to service one thing, the music. A newly formed super band fits this model, and they call themselves Aziza. And it features NEA jazz master Dave Holland, the guitar wizard Lena Lueke, percussion virtuoso Eric Harlan, and the multi-readist Chris Potter. And they will be appearing at this year's Soleil St. Lucia Summer Festival on May 11th in the Caribbean. It was actually Chris Potter who had the idea for the band when he was talking to his longtime friend Dave Holland. And Potter speaks to us about what it's like to play for a kind of leaderless band, all contributing equally to the music. And we also delve deep into the saxophonist's 20-year history of playing with Dave Holland, most regularly with the Dave Holland Quintet. Plus, we learn some little-known, fascinating facts about the near-flawless saxophonist Chris Potter, some of the imperfections of the multi-instrumentalist. This is The Checkout. Thanks for checking in. We're dreaming of mystic Muslims here on The Checkout. Blue Sufi is what you're listening to right now by the saxophonist Chris Potter. And not only are we going to be exploring his latest ECM recording, The Dreamer is the Dream, but also a recent recording he's made with Dave Holland. You might know the NEA jazz master. We're going to be surveying all kinds of music through Chris Potter's relationship with Dave Holland on this show. Speaking to him in his Brooklyn Park Slope, well, I won't be too specific, apartment. Thank you for joining us on The Checkout.
Thank you.
Take us back to the year when you met Dave Holland. I feel like listening to your music over the years and listening to Dave Holland's music, I can see why that works. I can see why that friendship is so strong.
Yeah, I think they're kind of shared areas of musical interest and just a way of looking at things that do have enough similarity and maybe enough differences as well to make it so that whenever we get together, whatever the situation is, it always feels like there's a lot of energy of creation involved. I think something that we share is a respect and much more than that, like a deep love for kind of the whole history of the jazz tradition, you know, and I think we've both made attempts to, you know, be able to deal with that and be able to play in all these different ways, you know, that have come before, but not with the thought of just doing it to recreate it, but of trying to find a way to keep the beautiful things about that tradition, but also change it as the world changes and as we experience new influences. Something that Dave was exploring before I met him as well, too, you know, using meters besides 4/4 and stuff like that, which not all musicians of his generation, actually very few of musicians of his generation were really into. That's an interest that I've always had as well, you know, and I think we realized when we started playing each other's music right away that was a natural point of focus that we could both work from.
Well, the Dave Holland Quintet from the late 90s and 2000s was considered to be sort of like the Miles Davis Quintet of that era, always on top of every critical poll and, you know, known for its incredible synergy among its players. Let's listen to you, the first tune you wrote for that outing called High Wire.
Right. Thank you.
Highwire. Did it feel to you like a Highwire act when you joined Dave Holland's band?
Yes, it did. It still does. Every time I play with them, it's great.
Celebrating 20 years, the love and chemistry and music of Chris Potter with Dave Holland, right there, 1998 recording of the Dave Holland Quintet. The other players, Billy Kilson, Steve Nelson, Dave Holland, Robin Eubanks. Dave Holland did play with Miles Davis, and he's played with Coleman Hawkins and Joe Henderson. Obviously, I imagine some of those tenor players had some kind of an influence on you.
Oh, certainly.
I always hear Joe Henderson in your playing.
Sure.
But do you hear Joe Henderson in your own playing?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, actually, the first time I met Dave, it was a double bill at the Blue Note, and I was playing with Red Rodney, and it was around the time that the Joe Henderson's Miles record came out. So I met Dave then. He was playing, that week was with Al Foster on drums, and instead of John Scofield, actually, it was Mike Stern on the guitar. So that was the week that I met all those guys. And this must have been, I don't know, 92 maybe, something like that. I just remember kind of saying hello. I mean, I was totally in awe, of course, of all of them, you know, and Joe Henderson, as you mentioned, I mean, of course, you know, is one of my longtime saxophone heroes. So, you know, I was just watching everybody walk by and like thinking, what could I possibly say? So I probably didn't say much of anything, you know, but that was the beginning of these relationships, I guess.
Chris Potter joins us here on the Checkout, and he'll be performing at the St. Lucia Soleil Summer Jazz Festival in the Caribbean coming up May 7th through the 13th. Not a bad place to play, I have to say. Not a bad gig.
No, we're all looking forward to that, definitely.
Have you ever played your guitar or piano in public?
Well, I played guitar every night we went out with Pat Metheny. There was this one tune he wrote for me to strum. So I got this beautiful acoustic guitar I got to play every day and strum my heart out. Yeah, I remember doing a gig at the Ryman Auditorium thinking, wow, I'm playing acoustic guitar on the same stage that Hank Williams did. Which, you know, kind of odd.
I don't think people know that you play these instruments is mainly my point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, piano every now and then. I mean, that's my default jam session instrument, you know, if I'm going to sit in, often it'll be on piano because I really love playing piano. Sometimes at home, I use it more than the saxophone. You know, I use it to write. And I've definitely used it on gigs before. You know, I'm not going to pretend to be, you know, Herbie Hancock, but it just as kind of a textural thing.
So when you came to the fore and everyone's imagination and everyone started getting aware of your work, you were, you know, often called a prodigy or this prodigal player, which almost has its pitfalls, I feel like, and could be almost annoying to kind of shed that label. Mm-hmm. Have you grown past that now?
Yeah, you know what the secret to that is just getting old. No, I don't know. No, I mean, the way that I always looked at it is that I was on a path and I, you know, I felt like there was something I wanted to express in music and what that is develops as I develop and, you know, as I change as a person and go through life, that's going to be reflected in music. I really look at music as a, you know, something that can last your whole life long. You can be looking for it and looking for something new. You know, so hopefully that's reflected in maybe what you hear over the course of my career, that there's a, I don't know if it's a growth, but it's a change. And I think it'll, you know, probably keep doing that.
Well, let's listen to what you referred earlier to in adapting different musical traditions in your own music, in your own writing. On your latest recording, The Dreamer is the Dream. He is dreaming. Chris Potter probably was in a dreamlike state when he wrote this ilimba.
The name of the instrument is the ilimba. It's kind of like a thumb piano, but from Eastern Africa. So instead of a kolimba, I guess in that region it's called an ilimba. And it's kind of a square box kind of thing with a whole bunch of tines that you play. So I came up with the riff that's kind of the basis for the tune on this instrument, which is why I named it that. And that's the sound that you hear at the beginning of the tune.
So you name your recording The Dreamer is the Dream. This is where we heard this latest track. And that's right. That's the state, right? I feel like that's the human condition that we all need to have, because in dreams are also sort of a metaphor of hope. And if you stop having something to hope for or dream about, what's the point of living?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the name of the song came to me, honestly, was from the very beginning of the melody, because it goes da 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 da, which I just thought, the dreamer is the dream. That's as far as I got as far as lyrics. But that just occurred to me. And yeah, I mean, the idea is something like, yeah, maybe the things that we hold on to so nervously, you know, full of stress as reality, maybe it's all a dream, and there's no need for all that stress.
The dream insinuates kind of like embracing the process. It's all about not the destination, but the journey. It sort of connotes that idea. And I feel like the vessel that is Aziza or the Dave Holland Quintet is all about that. It's really showing up with kind of not necessarily a simple lead sheet, but like not too much. Not like kind of a structure.
Right.
And you just come in and you just bring the baddest musicians. Right. And it's like, here you guys go, now blow in your case.
Right, right, right. Well, that's, I mean, I think that's, you know, some sort of a big secret to any great jazz ensemble, I mean, is oftentimes the written material, you know, can be written on maybe a half sheet of paper. But then we can go for an hour on a tune if we wanted, you know, because it's all about the invention and the creativity and the listening that the musicians do. You know, when we first got together with Lionel and Dave and Eric, I think there was a feeling among all four of us that, wow, this just works. Like, we don't have to say that much. We can just really be free. This is one of the real important things about jazz music, is that it puts the emphasis on this kind of interaction between people. You know, hopefully it's the kind of thing that can inspire us to be better people. I mean, I sometimes feel like I'm, you know, hoping that I can achieve the levels of spontaneity and relaxation and whatever in normal life that I do when I'm playing music.
Chris Potter, at least among my peers and the people that listen to your music, there is a kind of like flawlessness. And I'm sure people tell you that all the time. And like Dave Holland, quite frankly. I mean, Dave Holland comes into a session and just crushes it one take usually, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And I feel like you sort of have those skills as well. With that said, what's the most challenging improvisational session that you've ever been a part of in your life? Because I feel like everything is basically almost a breeze to you at this point.
Wow, that's an interesting question. I mean, every night is a situation where you're not sure where it's going to come from, and there are some nights that feel like, wow, I wasn't able to deliver what I wanted to deliver for whatever reason, you know, fatigue or bad read, you know, or the sound, you know, or just some funny feel, you know. It's really hard to say.
A bad read. Tell me what happens. When does that happen?
I generally try to make different kinds of reads work, because different ones, you know, kind of put you in a different direction. Some are kind of nice in the upper register and not that great down low. Others are the opposite. Some are like a little too hard or a little too soft or a little too squeaky or a little too this or a little too that.
I never hear you squeak, though.
Well, It does happen from time to time. I've been known to.
So did you ever have like a reed completely sabotage you during like a really like high stakes performance?
I don't know if it's sabotage because, again, you know, you end up working with the limitations that your tools afford you. You know what I mean? So it might feel like, oh, wow, there's, you know, I just really can't go above a certain note. It's just not going to happen. So you try and invent something to play that's doesn't involve that, which, again, is an opportunity for creativity, you know?
There you go.
But there are some nights I listen back and I go, you know, Chris, you really could have spent another 5 minutes just looking for a little better read, really.
That's so funny. Let's take you to a composition. At least one of the first times I heard you start writing for a larger ensemble, which is the Dave Holland Octet in 2010 from his recording Pathways. Mm-hmm. And you wrote this tune, Sea of Marmara. Thank you. listening to Chris Potter's music, here featured with Dave Holland's Octet. Chris Potter is performing with Dave Holland's Aziza at the St. Lucia Soleil Summer Jazz Festival, May 7th through the 13th, and gives us a great pleasure to speak with him from his Brooklyn home. What are some of Dave Holland's best stories about some of these legends he's played with?
There's definitely some Miles stories. But I remember one, you know, one thing he'd sometimes say about when he first joined that band. Herbie Hancock was playing piano. Tony Williams was playing drums. Wayne Shorter was playing saxophone. And he said that just the way that Miles found him, that he just heard him, I think, playing with, you know, a singer at Ronnie Scott's in London, and sent for him to come to New York. I mean, that's kind of insane. There was something that Miles heard that, you know, he knew what he was doing, but I mean, it's amazing. The more I think about it, that Miles was able to hear what Dave was really about, even though he was doing a gig which didn't really showcase any of the things that he probably wanted, you know, was interested in him for. But he obviously got the right guy, you know. But apparently, you know, there was no rehearsal. There was really not much of anything. They just showed up on the bandstand, and Dave said he felt like nobody was listening to a note he was playing. It was so disorienting. He said it was kind of rough. And
that's just because a reflection of how free the band was.
I think it was how free the band was. Also, at that point, I think they had been going through a lot of different bass players because Ron Carter wanted to stay in New York. You know, he didn't want to go on the road. And I think Miles was looking for something different anyway. So they had been playing with all these bass players. I remember sitting at a table with Herbie Hancock and Dave, and, you know, Dave was kind of telling the story, and Herbie said, yeah, well, you know, if you want to know the truth, like, basically there was a different bass player every night, so we just got used to not listening to the bass player. So I think it took a while for Dave to, you know, kind of establish his, you know, that there was a real good reason that he was there. You know, and the rest is history, as they say.
Chris Potter, let's go to another one of your compositions, something that you wrote for Dave Holland. This is when Nate Smith took the chair of the drum seat, replacing Billy Kilson. This is your tude, Vicissitude.
I think I got that title from Steve Nelson, the vibraphone player in the band, who's kind of a big hero to everyone in that band and a lot of others of us too. And I just remember, I think I hadn't seen him for a while, so I was like, hey Steve, how's it going? He's like, oh, you know, okay, just, you know, the vicissitudes of life. I went, all right, there's the name for that tune.
Wow.
Thank you.
you strike me, Chris Potter, and please correct me if I'm wrong or being presumptuous, but not only do you have the gift of music, or you are naturally endowed with these talents for music, obviously playing all these instruments almost perfectly, but like, you seem very disciplined too. Do you have a major ups and downs? And maybe if you have, what was your lowest point of when you're trying to struggle?
Sure. I'd say it's not easy. I mean, I think anytime you're involved in doing something creative for a living, it's necessarily going to feel like it's a reflection of who you are as a person. So if people accept it, you feel accepted as a person. And if they don't, then maybe you don't. You know, the way it works is, you know,
do you suffer from low self-esteem sometimes?
I mean, to a certain extent. You know, if you don't have, there's a certain thing of, self-awareness and self-doubt can really be a very important thing. I mean, if you think of someone that has no self-doubt at all, I mean, maybe they're a genius and they can get away with it, but usually it means they're kind of full of hot air. Like, there's not enough reflection to go, okay, well, can I really back this up, you know? And is it really as good as it possibly can be? Because it's those moments when things aren't going so well that you start to ask yourself maybe the kinds of questions that you need to ask in order to get to a new place, you know? You know, the episode that comes to mind, this is something that happened when I was in my mid-20s, was I got this disease in my inner ear, Meniere's disease. So I was getting dizzy spells all the time that just came out of nowhere and left out of nowhere. You never knew when, where, how long. And I also lost pretty much all the hearing in my left ear. And I didn't know if it was going to happen in my right ear as well. You know, I was really, I mean, if you talk about an existential problem, I was looking at the idea that, you know, maybe I wouldn't be able to do this. That, I was freaking out. I was definitely freaking out. I mean, I don't have any hearing still in that ear.
Really? But, you lost all of your hearing in your left ear?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. But, how many people know that?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't made it a secret, but I guess, I mean, it's not something that would just come up in a normal interview.
So you hear everything in mono now?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So if the drums set up on my left side, they can bash. It's not too loud for me. It's kind of, you know, it's like anything else. Something that's a weakness, you can use it as a strength as well.
that's like some Beethoven stuff right here.
Well, it's not that bad because I can hear just fine.
Have you talked to, when was the last time you talked about that?
I don't remember.
do musicians know this about you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, anyone who's been on the road with me knows it, because if they sit on my wrong side in a crowded restaurant, I can't hear what they're saying. So, yeah.
So do you think if you, like, God forbid, you did lose your complete hearing, Chris Potter, do you think you would be able to continue playing?
No, not in the same way. No, because there's no way. I mean, as I was saying earlier, you know, it's the whole thing is about listening to what other people are doing.
Especially in jazz, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I could imagine composing, but I couldn't really imagine performing. And there's also, like, there's so much about the saxophone and just trying to play in tune, but there's not just in tune. There's, you know, a million different degrees of, okay, maybe you want to approach this note a little high or a little low, or, you know, scoop it up or, you know, there's just all these extreme details that if you don't hear what you're working with, then there's just no way you could do it. But, you know, I don't anticipate that happening anytime soon. So,
yes,
I count my lucky stars.
Thank you. I bet in the summer of 2015, you had visions or maybe dreams of going to the Caribbean because you wrote this tune, right?
Uh-huh. Right. Summer 15. It was one of those things. Whenever you write a song, you know, and I tend to use Sibelius to save the music once I have it written. So you end up with about a gazillion tunes that could just be called untitled. So I had to remind myself of something about what it was. So Summer 15. And then I brought it in and everyone thought, you know, that's actually a good name for the tune. I said, well, okay, fine. Because it does have a bit of a calypso, but in five, Summer 15 it is. I was kind of thinking of it calypso, but also a little African, which kind of ties into Lionel's, his way of incorporating music from his native Africa, from Benin, along with a very, very sophisticated jazz harmony and jazz rhythmic language and, you know, use of different meters. I mean, so I was thinking of him. I mean, I knew that this would be for the Aziza group.
Well, Chris Potter, thank you for spending some time with us here on the Checkout and talking about your music and shedding some light on your process as a composer, but also telling us about the imperfections of Chris Potter. This is maybe new ground.
Oh, we're are you breaking kidding? Here. No, that's where I live.
And definitely check him out at the St. Lucia Soleil Summer Jazz Festival beginning May 7th with Aziza. What do you do in St. Lucia besides hear jazz music?
It's been a long time since I was there, but there's a group of friends I went with years ago, and I had my 30th birthday there.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing I remember from there, there's this kind of yellow hot sauce that you need to try, but be careful of. I forget what kind of pepper it is. That stuff is so delicious. Like, I came back with 3 or 4 bottles, you know, but it can creep up on you.
That's what you remember your
well, I mean, not the only thing, but that was a big takeaway.
Oh, thanks, man.
Thank you. Looking forward. Thank you.
Summer 15 by the saxophonist Chris Potter, written for Aziza, featuring him, Lena Lueke on guitar, Dave Holland, and Eric Harland. Put out on Dave Holland's own label, Dare 2 Records, in 2016. We thank Chris Potter for joining us on today's edition of The Checkout, and we're looking forward to seeing him in the Caribbean at St. Lucia. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to the Checkout podcast. You can get it on iTunes and Stitcher. I want to give a shout out to our production intern, Anthony Nieves. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.